This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. It's time for Law and Behold, our ongoing series aimed at improving constitutional literacy among Malaysians, done in collaboration with the Malaysian Bar and the University of Malaya's Faculty of Law. Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Syed Salim Farooqi, a professor of constitutional law at the University of Malaya, is with me today. And since it was Human Rights Day on Tuesday, we wanted to discuss some new threats and challenges to human rights, but also opportunities to protect the human rights of all people. Welcome, Prof. How are you today?
Thank you very much, Juliet, and hello to all your listeners.
Lovely to have you back on the show. So, Prof, you know, Human Rights Day, it's observed every year on the 10th of December, which is, of course, the day which back in 1948, I think, the UN General Assembly adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So, you know, as we've discussed before, our constitution that provides guarantees and safeguards of various fundamental rights and liberties of its citizens and people. Would you say that the Malaysian Federal Constitution's fundamental liberties section is somewhat similar or quite similar to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as well?
Yes. Yeah, well, may I preface my remarks by saying that the development of international human rights, the globalization of human rights, ranks amongst the most significant accomplishments of international law in the last 70 years. And you're right that the international movement for human rights has found reception in most constitutions. There are about 180 constitutions in the world. Most of them have provisions for human rights. In Malaysia, Articles 5 to 13 has a chapter called Fundamental Liberties. Article 5 is personal liberty, and that's Article 3 of the Universal Declaration. Mm-hmm. Article 6 is abolition of slavery. Article 7 is prohibition of backdated criminal laws. Article 7 also protects us against repeated punishment. Article 8 is equality. 9 is movement. 10 is speech, assembly, association. 11 is religion. 12 is rights and respect of education. 13 is right to property. Mm-hmm. Now, almost all these articles are have their counterpart in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But I have to mention something here, and that is this, that the idea of human rights now has developed into what could be called three dimensions. Mm-hmm. First of all, the civil and political rights. We call them first-generation rights. Our Constitution is very good in recognizing those. Then there are what are called socio-economic rights, the second-generation rights, which rest on the assumption that food is as important as freedom, mm-hmm, and bread is as important as the ballot box. Mm-hmm. This category of rights includes, for example, minimum wages, right to water, food, shelter, jobs, roads, medical benefits, education. Now, there is a problem here, and that is this, that most constitutions are afraid to include second-generation socioeconomic rights in their chapter on fundamental liberties. Because if you have a right, then there is a corresponding duty.
That's right.
Which means people could go to the court. And because all these rights, quote, rights, have economic, massive economic implications, governments are worried to include them in a chapter on human rights. So the approach of Malaysia, India, and many other countries is to recognize these rights, but not in the constitution, but in ordinary law. For example, the rights of workers are protected in the Employment Act, Industrial Relations Act. Protection for women is there in the Domestic Violence Act. Family rights are in various family law provisions. So that's one thing that I have to point out to you, that our constitution is concentrating on civil and political rights, not socioeconomic rights. Mm-hmm. Then there is this third category of rights I was talking about, development rights, uh-huh, sustainable development. And there is a beautiful idea here in legal philosophy, the rights of future generations. Mm-hmm. And while our constitution is silent on that, very few constitutions venture into socioeconomic rights or rights of future generations. But I would think that your readers will agree that rights must belong not only to you and me. They must belong to our children.
Yes.
And to our children's children. In other words, the rights of future generations. So that's an area where the Constitution needs to traverse. It needs to enter. And that is socioeconomic rights and the rights of future generation development rights.
So, you know, these rights are clearly enshrined in our Constitution, but would you say that there have been somewhat of a breakdown and, you know, some of these rights have been, shall we say, trampled upon by those in power?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. There's always a gap between the law in the book and the law in action everywhere in the world. Look at the American Constitution, a constitution of liberty, but actually till the 1960s, the blacks were regarded as subhuman,
mm-hmm.
and there had to be a Civil Rights Act in 1964 to give to the blacks even such simple rights as the right to enter into a university, which was populated mostly by the whites. So yes, there's always a gap between theory and practice, and indeed in Malaysia, this gap existed. Not because of the Constitution's chapter on fundamental liberties, but because the Constitution was born at a time when we had a communist insurgency.
That's right.
And along with the chapter on fundamental liberties, there was this Article 149 subversion, an Article 150 emergency. And Parliament employed its powers under 149 and 150 extensively. And I'm sorry to report that emergency declared in 1964 lasted till 2011, nearly 47 years, whereby during an emergency or laws under subversion can suspend almost all the fundamental rights.
Right.
So many of our fundamental rights were suspended explicitly by emergency and subversion laws, because the Constitution permitted. Now, the sad consequence or downstream effect of these emergency and subversion laws was that a culture of omnipotence, all-powerfulness, developed.
Mm.
Human rights were subordinated to security and public order. Indeed, security, public order is very important, but in every society, there must be a balance. We need rights and we need stability. We need both. The might of the state and the rights of the citizens must go hand in hand.
That's right.
There should be no question of saying one is more important than the other, because security, public order, law and order, control of crime are very important. But at the same time, freedom must be allowed to reign and rights must be allowed to flower. So I think that was the problem. Because of the laws against subversion, many of which laws are still in operation, and the laws against emergency, which now have been lifted, because emergency was lifted in 2011 November, I think, many of our fundamental rights were eclipsed. Not only Parliament through laws eclipsed our fundamental rights, the courts were not vigilant in upholding human rights. And a psychology developed. People began to think in terms of the absoluteness of the need for security and public order rather than a balance. So I think we had an eclipse of human rights for about 47 years. But I have to report to you, and I think we must give credit where credit is due. Now freedom is in the air. At least there is some freedom in the air. And very quickly one could rattle off a few positive developments. Students have been given more freedom because ACTA University College, University Colleges Act was amended. The Fake News Act was repealed. There is much more freedom for assemblies and associations. The police job last time was under the Police Act 1967, Section 27. The police job was basically to prohibit, to control. Now the police job has radically shifted to facilitating, to permitting assemblies to go on and making sure that there is no disruption by counter demonstrators. So the police role has radically altered. The press, I think, is less restrained. The alternative media, oh, it's very, very powerful. There's an independent commission to investigate any abuse in the police. Electoral rights have been massively expanded. Mm-hmm. Though, of course, it's taking some time to create a new electoral roll of 4 more million voters. For the first time a few months ago, the Human Rights Commission report was debated in Parliament.
Yes.
Since 1999, they were submitting reports which were nicely shelved. The death penalty is before a committee for examination. In general, there is today discussion before decision, which is, in my view, a prerequisite of democracy. But of course, the problem is this, that we Malaysians are always so used to quick decisions from the top down, that when there is a democratic discussion which leads to delay, people are saying, see, promises are not being fulfilled. Actually, that's not true. The process of discussion is going on. For example, on the death penalty, the committee is headed by the former Chief Justice Tan Sri Richard Malanjan, and they're examining the issue. And by the way, the courts are on the upswing. Just at the beginning of this year, there was a remarkable decision, a decision that actually any country, even a Western democratic country would be proud of. In the case of Alman Nudo Atenza, the issue was this, that a lady had been arrested and charged and convicted for a drug offense. Mm. Under the drug law, there is not one, there are two assumptions, those two presumptions that work against the accused. One presumption is that if you are in possession of some goods, then you are presumed to have knowledge of everything inside your suitcase or your cupboard or your room or your car.
That's
so
right.
Possession implies knowledge. Second assumption, and if you have possession and knowledge, then you are presumed to be a drug trafficker. And because you're a drug trafficker, therefore, there is 39B mandatory death penalty. Mm. So in Almanudo, the court said, under Article 5 of the Constitution, no person shall be deprived of life or liberty save in accordance with law. The word law does not mean any law whatsoever. No matter how arbitrary. The word law means a law that is proportionate.
Mm.
Now, that is remarkable that the judge are reading into the word, the judges, unanimous federal court, read into the word law. Not just the law found in the Warta Kerajaan or in the drugs law. They said, inside the act, we must color, we must shade in the moral color of proportionality. So the law must be proportionate. Some people will say proportionality is similar to reasonableness, perhaps, but the courts use the word proportionality. So I think the courts are on the upswing, but nevertheless, there are still many hindrances, but I'll let you ask that question if you wish.
Yes, and we are going to do that after this quick break. I'm speaking today to Emeritus Professor Dr. Shahd Salim Farooqi. He is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Malaya, and it's our Law and Behold series. And today we are looking at human rights, since it was just Human Rights Day on Tuesday. So we're discussing new threats, challenges, and also opportunities. And we'll be back after this quick break. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. In the studio with me today is Emeritus Emeritus Professor, Dr. Shad Salim Faruqi. He's a professor of constitutional law at the University of Malaya. It's our Law and Behold series. And since it was International Human Rights Day on Tuesday, we're discussing new threats, challenges and opportunities with regard to human rights, of course. So, I mean, Prof, you know, you gave so many good, opportunities that have come up, you know, in these last few months, yes. You know, I suppose since May 2018. But, you know, there are some people who are, let's say, unhappy about things that haven't changed since May 2018. I mean, some of them would be that, you know, the Malaysian government has not ratified some international treaties like ICERD, for example. And we've discussed this before, but do you think that is really a step back, you know, that the Pakatan government didn't ratify things that they had promised in their manifesto?
Yes, indeed. There is cause for disappointment. But I have to point this out that the hindrances, the obstacles in the way of human rights do not come only from the government. We have to take note of this fact that the old laws are very much in operation. So whether it's the penal code or POCA or POTA or SOSMA, they're very much there. And repealing them or amending them requires an entire legislative process. And in trying to repeal or amend them, we have to take note that there are in society a lot of other powerful institutions, sometimes that live in the shadows. In other words, they are subterranean, what is often called the deep state,
right,
or the state within a state, that would hinder the passage or the repeal of such laws. Take, for example, the effort to pass a special commission on the police,
yeah,
and look at the obstacles that are being faced. The hindrances are, first of all, there are many old laws are still in operation. There are many powerful institutions that stand in the way of change. Public opinion is not entirely favorable to the passage of some laws. I've been involved, for example, in the dialogue on death penalty. And let me say this to you very plainly. There are a lot of people who support the death penalty. Mm-hmm. They say, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to say that someone kills should not be killed?
Yeah.
So laws are not the only thing. Government's will is not the only thing. There are many hindrances. There are many areas like the rights of the Orang Asli, the natives, children, women, migrants, foreign workers, asylum seekers. These are areas, huge, huge areas where actually changes are needed and the changes are not coming. Sadly, a very significant factor in this country is that many of us, ordinary citizens, we have tremendous tenderness for our own rights, but not the rights of others. As we were talking about it earlier, the first function of freedom should be to free someone else. But sadly, amongst our citizens, there is very little concern for the rights of others, especially if the other happens to belong to a different race, a different religion, a different region, or a different gender. There is very little concern. So I think in some respects, the change has to come not only from the government, but also inside us. We have not internalized a culture of human rights. And by human rights, I'm not talking simply about issues of due process and no torture. I'm talking of things like environmental degradation. We pollute the drains, we dirty the drains, we throw garbage inside, we pollute the rivers. And then, of course, as you were mentioning, we complain about flooding or choked drains,
yeah,
not realizing, of course, our own role in all this.
Mm-hmm.
The deep state has tremendous power to scuttle. For example, the Rome Statute and ICERD were scuttled, basically, by the deep state. There is racism, religious extremism, and this is often used as an excuse to delay changes. There is a problem of environmental degradation. our economic policies, our development, so-called development policies, are basically destructive of human rights of many sections of the community. There is overlogging. There is pollution of rivers. Hills are being raised. There are problems of lack of high-quality education and health care. We are adopting more and more market economy in areas like health care and high-quality education. Now, reliance on the private sector perpetuates inequality. Very sadly, I have to say this, that our medical health system was one of the finest in Asia. But now we are regressing, partly because the budget is not rising commensurate with need, and partly because even public hospitals are having now private wings, which are rather expensive, and there's, of course, the private sector. There are many other areas, Juliet, where new threats are emerging. For example, how will the workers' rights be protected in a society, in a workplace where there's going to be a lot of artificial intelligence, where computers take over jobs? I'm told 40% or so of the workers may be redundant if we were to really rely on computers and artificial intelligence. Computerization has become a real threat to our privacy. How do we protect citizens, ordinary citizens, from freedom from surveillance? May I also mention, though this would not be ordinarily regarded as an issue of human rights, corruption, which is endemic, is a serious threat to human rights, because what it does is that it rechannels funds allocated for the poor, the needy, the marginalized. Funds channeled for them are actually rechanneled into the pockets of those who are already part of the elite. So all these threats are there, and one has to be a little bit fair. Human rights cannot be resolved simply by passing a law. Of course, passing a law itself is a challenge in a democracy. If it was all top-down, the authoritarian leader said, so be it, I want the law by today, so be it. That would be easy.
Yeah.
But you see, as I said earlier, we are now resorting to consultation. For example, on the abolition of the death penalty or mandatory death penalty, the commission is traveling around the country listening to opinion, the committee, not the commission, and things are slow. So I think the challenges are many, but nevertheless, the process must continue. And I think each one of us has a role to play. I've said this before, that even if one person, one lone individual stands up for human rights and says, hey, wait a minute, this is wrong, I think that would encourage others to speak up. And as I've said before, I think in the desert, sometimes sand dunes grow around a single blade of grass. So I think each one of us has a duty to become that single blade of grass around which a sand dune will grow.
I just wanted to pick on something that you talked about, you know, how, you know, for us, we don't really consider the trade-off between human rights and other things that people hold dear when it comes to our material well-being. And so that struck me about, you know, the rights of our indigenous communities in Malaysia, you know, and under the constitution and the laws of Malaysia, actually, Orang Asli and indigenous communities, they actually retain customary rights over their traditional territories. But of course, you know, as you said, the increased demand for lands and resources and all of that, that has actually resulted in acute encroachment and appropriation, you know, of the remaining areas inhabited by these local indigenous communities. So let's just look at the courts, right? Do you feel that the Malaysian appellate courts, they are actually properly dealing with the issue of these competing needs between the state, the private interests, and also the indigenous communities over land?
Certainly, the courts can do a better job here. But I have to say this, that not only the courts, Parliament is gravely deficient in this area. Actually, the Constitution in Article 8 specifically provides for special protection for the Orang Asli. Mm-hmm. And then Article 153, which deals with the special position of the Malays, also includes the special position of the natives of Sabah and Sarawak. Sadly, however, Parliament has not really been active in this area. Maybe it's because around the world, the law is a laggard. He's a lazy fellow. The law is a lazy fellow. The law doesn't act. It reacts. Mm. It reacts to demands. So I think that should be the next step. I think the Orang Asli and those who on human rights ground support them and the natives of Sabah, Sarawak, I think they should organize. I think they should raise their voices of concern. Then only the law will expand to meet the needs. But I fully agree with you. Neither the courts nor Parliament have been active in this area. Court decisions generally have tried to walk the middle path by saying, well, the Orang Asli and the natives have a right to the usufruct of the land, the fruits, but not the land itself.
Mm-hmm.
So the traditional ownership of land is normally not awarded. Normally, though there are some cases where courts have recognized customary titles. But in general, the attitude of the courts is that you have a right to the fruit or to the crop that you planted, but not the land itself. And I don't entirely blame the courts because actually in many countries where, like Australia, where native rights have been recognized, there is this phenomena of two steps forward, one step back, and three steps forward and two steps back. So this is an area, very challenging area. But without doubt, the law is structurally biased. The National Land Code is structurally biased in the sense that it regards ownership as referring to that piece of title I have in the land office.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't apply that kind of thinking to native land
mm-hmm.
or to the Orang Asli land. But that's the problem, I think, in all legal systems. Many legal systems, many laws are based on what could be called structural injustices, assumptions or presumptions, principles that basically favor the status quo.
That's right.
So, let me just give you an example of Article 13, right to property. If you have the funds, you can go and buy 10 houses,
mm-hmm.
and that's allowed by the law. But which means that you are withdrawing property from the market. You are creating an artificial shortage. Actually, there should be some restrictions, some ceilings on ownership of landed property. But you see, when you say that, people will say, you are being revolutionary. But you look at it this way. There are people who own 10, 20, 30 pieces of land. In India at one time, the zamindars, the landlords, would own thousands and thousands of acres of land. And the farmers were nothing but tenants.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that in many societies, there was a problem of what could be called actually indentured labor. Basically, you're working on the land to pay back your debt. Now, this is structural injustice in the sense that there is a fundamental right to property, which means if I have the money, I can go buy up as many houses, as many acres of land as I can. But the result of that is that monopolies are created.
Mm-hmm. And some would say slavery as a result of it.
Some would say yes, actually, in some respects, in the villages around the world, land reform is a serious need. And the point that you raised here actually is quite significant. Some human rights are destructive of other human rights.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's the dilemma, you know, we all have to face in the legal system, that you show tenderness for one right and actually end up impinging on many other rights. Human rights is, in that respect, an incredible challenge because you do something right in one area, you end up actually hurting people in other areas.
So, I mean, we're running out of time, but what would you hope for, you know, especially, you know, moving forward? I mean, what are some opportunities that we can, that can help us move forward, you know, in this very, very difficult terrain that we are trying to navigate?
Well, one area where I would like to mention, it's very close to me, though I know time is a problem. I think the 20th century saw concerted action against the authoritarian state. Mm-hmm. But I think the 21st century must seek protection for the weak, underdeveloped nations from cross-border violations by predatory nations. I'm thinking of situations like regime changes, humanitarian quote-unquote interventions, preemptive wars, economic blockades, weapons of mass destruction, militarism which fuels conditions for violation of socio-economic rights and loss of life. You know, Juliet, drug trafficking is a heinous offense.
That's right.
But selling of weapons of mass destruction is a fashionable business. Now, surely, in the 21st century, we need to control the spread of nuclear weapons, spread of weapons of mass destruction. There is an impending environmental catastrophe. The dumping of wastes in Asian and African countries by nations of the West who actually otherwise talk of human rights but want to export their hazardous waste to us. Overfishing of the seas. We need to move away from a cooperation-based society and put economic activities under social control. We need to look at the pluses and minuses of economic globalization, how actually the domination of Asian economies and social life by transnational corporations is hurting our indigenous small-scale and family businesses. The debt stranglehold by the West over Asian societies. The indigenous resources are falling to Western patents and trademarks. I think we need a national heritage protection law.
I agree.
Both at the national and international level to protect actually our indigenous resources. And there are many other issues, but of course time is a problem. I'll just say this. Oh yes, one thing I must mention. I must not forget. In this post-truth era, if I may put it that way.
Yes.
False news. Technology exists actually to make us say and act things we actually never said or did. Because technology can make me deliver a speech which I never delivered. Cyberspace has become a dumping ground for our gutter instincts and human feelings of hate, sensationalism. So I think there are many, many such challenges to human rights in the future. To sum up, the challenges are three types. One is, of course, of the authoritarian state. Number two, cross-border challenges across the border from big nations, very powerful. And thirdly, of course, the challenge to human rights from individual indifference. What we talked about earlier, how actually we show concern about our rights, but not the rights of our neighbors, not the rights of the others. Mm-hmm. And that certainly is wrong, because if human rights are to flower, then it is not possible for these rights to flower if some are free and some are enslaved. I think everyone must be free.
Thank you so much, Prof. I've been speaking to Emeritus Professor Dr. Shahd Salim Farooqi. He's a professor of constitutional law at the University of Malaya, and we were discussing human rights, some new threats and challenges, and also opportunities. If you miss any part of this show or any previous Law and Behold episodes, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.